Hello, everybody, and welcome to RVW Wealth Wisdom Podcast, where we share some practical tips and knowledge for investors. I'm Stefan So, and with me today is our senior team member, Jonathan Gerber, and Daniel Prince, head of iShares Product Consulting for BlackRock. It is our pleasure to welcome you today, Daniel, and we're very grateful to host you.
Yeah, Stefan, thank you for having me on your show.
Great. So one of the things that we really try to do is really explain some of the investment philosophies and what we like to our client base in a very easy to understand manner. And when we went through some of the investments that we like, you know, QUAL is what we're going to talk today. And that's been a very interesting, you know, investment for multiple reasons. But one of the things that, you know, I think it's really highlighted for is that it looks at companies exhibiting positive fundamentals. So I think that's very interesting. Some of the things are the high return on equity and some of the more technical terms. So could you go over a little bit what that means and why QUAL is more effective than, let's say, market cap weighted funds?
Yeah, so that's, you know, QUAL is our iShares MSCI USA Quality Factor ETF. That's a little bit, let me unpack that a little bit, right? You know, if you think about the ETF industry, really in the early 2000s, we launched a lot of market cap weighted indexes. So if you want to own the market, you can buy one of our ETFs. And what we realized over time is that investors are also looking for different ways to start to cut up the markets in what were traditionally active management strategies. And if you really lean on some of the academic research, you realize you could start to build portfolios in a more intentional way by separating the wheat from chaff and not just buying the broad market. So QUAL, Q-U-A-L, is one of those ETFs that starts to separate the market from different various factors, we'll call them. Okay. Now, factors are these things that are like these long-term rewarded aspects of what impacts a stock. And what we're trying to do is really harness capturing these factors in a portfolio that could lead to potential outperformance. So in the spirit of what quality is trying to do, is trying to build a portfolio full of quality companies. And the way that we screen the broad market for quality companies is we look for companies that will return a high return on equity, so delivering net income to their shareholders. We look for companies that can do that with low leverage, so not taking on a lot of debt to achieve that net income. And also companies that don't have a lot of earnings surprises. They have very consistent earnings growth. Now, what you find is companies that take on a lot of debt can do pretty well, but they're not necessarily going to do well in certain environments. Companies that take on a lot of income but have a lot of debt share that. And companies that produce returns or earnings that are very consistent tend to be rewarded pretty well by the market. So to really summarize what we're trying to do, it's build a portfolio of companies that could potentially outperform the broad market just by screening by those several measures.
Sounds like you're describing how an investor might buy a business. Those are exactly the descriptions and the concepts I would use if I went out to actually buy a whole business down the block, and applying that to capital markets, an environment where you're choosing from thousands of stocks or thousands of ETFs available. I appreciate that insight, Daniel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, at the end of the day, you are buying businesses, right? It is a portfolio full of stocks, and the way that you should think about building a book of stocks, it's like buying businesses. You are effectively buying businesses. Yeah.
And given that we're CPAs, what you said about, you know, low leverage, you know, really resonates with us. Can you talk about maybe what that means when you're looking at the balance sheet, for example, and how you define that?
Yeah. So looking at debt to equity is quite simply the metric that we'll look at, right? So companies that take on a high degree of debt with respect to the amount of equity can do pretty well, but are really susceptible to borrowing rates. Really susceptible to a little bit of volatility, and you're really borrowing to get your return. More quality companies will be able to return capital or income to investors without taking on a lot of leverage. So we quite simply will screen for debt to equity and look for companies with relatively low leverage inside of their fundamentals.
How do you weight, or what are the different metrics or methodologies of weighting once you've established the list or universe of quality companies?
Absolutely. So first we start with a broad market universe, a market cap weighted index from MSCI. And from there, we screen by the metrics that we just discussed. Once you isolated stocks that have a high degree of quality for those different metrics we looked at, the key question is, how do you weight that portfolio? And the way that our indexes or MSCI's indexes will weight those stocks will be a function of both their quality score times its market capitalization. Now, the reason why you might want to consider weighting by both is, first, you're trying to harness quality companies, so you need to weight them by their quality score. So we take those three measures and we create a composite score based off of those three. The reason why you want to meet that with the intersection of market cap is you want to allow for capacity and liquidity and some sort of market representation. So you need to balance the real world with the theoretical world of just looking at balance sheet items and putting them in a list. So that's how the stocks within QUAL, or we call it QUAL, is weighted.
And Jonathan asked a really interesting question, given that, you know, interest rates are going to continue to go up. How do you think that composition might change? And I think, since this is a quality screen, companies that are more quality oriented are going to do better, maybe in a situation where companies are going to have more interest expenses.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we are. I don't have a really great crystal ball on what inning we are. We always talk about what inning of the market we are. Feels like we're later than we are earlier. Now, typically at the end of an economic cycle, you know, when you start to see interest rate rises, folks tend to get a little bit more defensive. Companies that aren't taking on a leverage tend to do a little bit better towards the late cycle. So from an economic cycle standpoint, you know, when you're getting into more of the contraction area, quality companies tend to do better. They're not susceptible to rate rises as much as non-quality companies are, as defined by our methodology. It's also interesting to note that companies' fundamentals can change. And a quality company can become a non-quality company. So we do rebalance this portfolio twice a year. The index rebalances in May and November. And the spirit of that is to really keep the stocks fresh so that you have consistently quality companies without sort of seeing the fundamentals change. Because companies can change in their business prospects, their income. And we've seen some major companies become non-quality companies in the last few years.
Can you give us an example of a company that was quality and fell out, and something that our listeners might connect to because they might consume those products or know the company?
Yeah, so a good example of this, and I, you know, don't like to pick on companies too much, but GE. GE is a company that is excluded from qual today. They took on a lot of leverage. Their return on equity wasn't as high, and their earnings variability became too much. So GE was noticeably removed from the portfolio. Would have been quite some time ago, but that is a name, I think it's making a lot of headline news recently, that you wouldn't see inside the portfolio.
What replaced it? Give us an example of one of the companies that replaced it within the ETF.
Now, we don't swap one for one, right? We don't pair them each other and have them fight for ownership. But, you know, a company that does make it to the portfolio in an outsized weight is something like MasterCard. They have a very low leverage. They have a high return on equity, and their earnings growth has been fairly consistent. So it has a very outsized weight in the portfolio relative to its market cap weighting.
It's very helpful to hear real life examples of companies that we all interact with, and hearing how this index sees them.
Yeah.
And that's a great example. And for our listeners, let's say, that have a taxable account with us, you know, could you tell us a little bit more about why that swap in a regular taxable situation, if you're going one stock for the other, obviously would have some big tax consequences, whereas in this ETF structure, we haven't seen that. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, when I think about, and I'll call this ETF 2.0, like the next innovation in the ETF industry, has really been about capturing traditional active strategies or trying to capture factor premium. But it has been very hard to do in a very implementable real world way before ETFs. Mm-hmm. So some of these strategies have a little bit of slightly higher turnover. There could be potential tax consequences. And if you're doing that, just buying the individual stocks, you really need to think about transaction costs and the impact of capital gains. But with the introduction of the ETF structure, it has really allowed for the benefit of higher turnover strategies, buying losers, or buying winners, or having stocks appreciate and rebalancing, has been very, using the ETF structure has really enabled these strategies to become implementable and not just live in the theoretical land. And you see this across all the factors that we deliver, whether it's quality or value or momentum. These are all strategies that are harder to deliver in practice before the ETF structure. So if I think about what has changed for investors in the last decade? It's really been, how do you capture academic premium, but in the real world? And the ETF structure has been a bridge. So that, for example, Qual has been out for over 5 years. It has double-digit returns every year of the last 5 years. It's been a great 5 years. I'm not sure the next 5 years looks like that, but it has a great 5-year track record, and we've never paid a capital gain.
Yeah, and
that's the benefit of the ETF structure.
Tell us a little bit about the rules that are driving that rebalance.
Yeah, so MSCI, they're our preferred provider for factor-based smart beta ETFs. And so really they determine the rules, you know, in partnership with a firm like BlackRock and saying, is this the right exposure that we want? So in sort of MSCI's framework, this portfolio rebalances in May, it rebalances in November. And working with a firm like BlackRock, we were able to sort of decide on the rules, like what would be the best way to capture this quality or profitability factor. So that's when it rebalances inside the portfolio. Today, you're looking at anywhere about 125 stocks in that portfolio. And it's really pulling that from about a universe of 600 and or so large and mid-cap securities.
But there's no discretion. There's no manager saying, you know what? G's going to pull through.
Yeah.
They're going to clean up balance sheet and become quality again. Yeah. It's just they're in or they're out. And it's very Darwinian. And to us, that's very refreshing.
Yeah.
Because you know what you're getting and you get what you bought. Yeah. And that's a great way to invest and own. Are there any other – or give us another example of a – we talked about QUAL giving investors access to large and mid-cap U.S. stocks. Are there other sectors or an asset class where we can look to quality? Have we seen a successful way to implement a quality portfolio in fixed income or emerging markets? Or does this strategy we've just been discussing really work well only in the context of a larger mid-cap U.S. portfolio?
You know, the notion around more quality companies over time have historically outperformed the broad market can be extended to other asset classes, could be extended to asset classes within equities, so developed markets, in emerging markets. So really the theory around what drives the persistence of performance isn't unique to U.S. markets. It's really the notion that people overpay for companies that take on too much leverage. People overpay for earnings inconsistency. And over time, stripping out whether it's bonds, whether it's small cap stocks, has generally rewarded investors trying to strip out more quality stocks, bonds across the spectrum.
Does BlackRock have ETFs that are taking the same approach to other asset classes?
We do. It's slightly different. So we have a couple bond ETFs that will look at metrics other than what is your credit rating and duration. It'll look at areas on, you know, the health of the balance sheet and the distance towards default. So you know, this is maybe ETF 3.0. But you're starting to see innovation on the fixed income side that are harnessing the same things that exist on the equity side, but in fixed income space.
Give us a ticker example.
So we have a defensive high yield ETF out there that looks to try to credit screen the differences between a traditional high yield bond fund and or a high yield bond versus one that have greater quality characteristics, but are still considered high yield. So defensive high yield bond would be an example of that. Where we sort of move across asset classes. We also have an international version of Qual to really extend this across boundaries. Mm-hmm. Again, this phenomenon isn't just subjective to large cap. So we're seeing people build entire portfolios really trying to harness this academic risk premium, we call it, around factors.
You talked about the rebalancing in May and then in November. And I wonder what happens mechanically when that trade gets pushed through? When MasterCard gets bought in some huge volume to match the demand of and the composition of the ETF, are you seeing price movement as a result of your execution? Or is there enough liquidity in the primary and secondary liquidity of an ETF to satisfy the needs of your investors?
A couple ways to answer that, because it's not just us buying and selling. Okay. When ETFs are created and redeemed, they're generally done in kind. So around rebalance activity, our portfolio managers, and yes, ETFs have portfolio managers, we'll be very thoughtful about rebalancing. So we'll know what's coming down the road. Our index will rebalance, we'll get a new sheet, and our PMs have to be extremely thoughtful about transacting and turning over the portfolio. So first, we'll try to leverage the ETF structure. So if stocks are being removed, they'll be part of the redemption basket. If stocks are being introduced in the portfolio, they'll be part of the creation basket. This helps us really eliminate the transaction costs that you refer to.
For our listeners that are just tuning into this episode, could you go over what that in-kind means?
Sure. You know, comparing ETFs to traditional funds, you know, when you buy and sell an ETF, you do it on exchange, right? You don't interact directly with the mutual fund provider. You don't call me. You don't, you know, send me your money and I give you your portfolio. You interact on the exchange. To the extent that there's excess demand or supply for an ETF, they are then created or redeemed depending on the direction of demand. And for instance, if an ETF has higher demand, market makers will simply create more units of our ETF to satisfy demand in the secondary market, and they do so by delivering us the securities. It's a very tax-efficient way. It helps us externalize transaction costs, and it really helps us get from point A to point B in the most efficient way possible. That's how ETFs work. And the same if there's lack of demand. You see selling pressure. Market makers will redeem our fund by taking delivery of the underlying stocks in exchange for the excess shares in there. Works pretty well. It's been working for 25 years. It really does a good job to externalize it. So these higher turnover strategies can really be serviced well through that mechanism. Okay. The other part is maybe we don't have creations and redemptions near our rebalance activity. Our portfolio managers do need to be thoughtful about rebalancing the overall portfolio. In the case of Qual, it's over $7 billion fund now. We've had several billion in flows this year. To me, it's obvious we're sort of part of that cycle where people are looking for quality companies. But it's also a very large market. When you think about the market cap from which it pulls, we're talking about double-digit trillion-dollar market. So while to me, $2.5 billion in flows this year, a $7 billion fund is extremely large, it's really small relative to the underlying market. And to your question around the liquidity, it's a fairly liquid market there.
So the rebalance date, the magic date when the mandate of the ETF requires the disposition or the exchanging out of or the redemption of certain stocks and the introduction of others, we're not going to see necessarily an adverse market effect. There's sufficient liquidity in the marketplace to accommodate those, because that's sometimes something you hear when you're advocating for a mutual fund.
Yeah.
And that's really where I'm going with this discussion is, you know, the proponent of a mutual fund would say, well, the manager can actively manage the process of getting in and out in a more timely, staged manner as not to disrupt the market movements to conform to the mandate of the fund lineup or the ingredients lineup of the ETF. But what I'm hearing from you, Daniel, is that there is sufficient liquidity, particularly in this space, to manage that recomposition, to make sure you continue to hold the rules-based lineup of funds in the appropriate allocation without disrupting the market and allowing for the liquidity to achieve that.
Absolutely. I mean, you probably touched upon common questions. I must be following some mutual fund folks around. But first, very clearly, we have portfolio managers. They think about liquidity. They take discretion in trading. Their job is to track an index, yes. It has a certain date, yes. But we don't just naively trade our portfolio. They're extremely skilled. They're good at what they do, and they have a big bogey on their back called the index return. So we do have portfolio managers. Another thought around this is, you know, when the structure works pretty efficiently, and the way that I think about, you know, folks who are saying, oh, this is just done mechanically and it's robotic and it's not thinking about liquidity, it's missing the big picture. And the way that I think about it is, you know, in the medieval times, and sorry to get sort of on a story here, but in the medieval times, cartographers would make these maps, right? And the areas that weren't explored, that's where the dragons lived. And that's what they told folks. So, you know, perhaps to the untrained eye, maybe that's where the dragons live. But what I found in my career talking about ETFs is once you get folks pretty comfortable with the process and you start to understand the efficiencies, the dragons become a promised land.
Great.
And Jonathan actually asked a very interesting question earlier, which was, you know, how do factors work in large cap versus mid cap versus other asset classes? And what got me thinking was obviously at our core, we're CPAs. And for example, in the international space, you know, certain countries are more susceptible to paying dividends versus not paying dividends just because of tax laws. So could you just comment a little bit about what factors have you seen in your experience that work a little bit better? Maybe that doesn't work in the US.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you know, your point around, like, if you go by international market cap weighted, you get about 100 bips more in yield, right? So certain countries have more of a philosophy of paying out the returns in the form of more income. So you do start to see a little bit of behavior changes, but overall factors are really designed to capture market premium irrespective of sort of the asset class. You know, where factors tend to work more is where you see more non-standardized reporting. You guys are CPAs, so you understand GAAP reporting. So where you start to see companies that don't have a consistent ability to analyze across the spectrum. So as soon as you move away from developed markets, it starts to become more interesting from capturing premium from fundamental measures where you don't have standardization. So you do start to see premia outside the US in areas that are less efficient, like emerging markets, to capture, you know, these long-term drivers of return factors. I stayed pretty high level on that one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, broadly speaking, you do see some differences and divergences. But I would not characterize as like, hey, you got to go value in Canada and you've got to go momentum in the US. That'd be a not great way of looking at it.
Great. Can you just highlight some of the other factors that exist in the world of academia and research?
Sure.
I know we've talked a lot or exclusively about quality relative to this ETF, but help us understand, what are the other factors that are being studied and researched and marketed?
So a lot. So there's hundreds of factors that have been identified of what drive portfolios, but there's really only few factors that have really been studied and examined that have been what we call rewarded factors, meaning you want to have exposure to that. Right? There's a factor called volatility. And I don't think I need to tell your listeners that when volatility spikes, stocks don't like that. Right? That is a factor that negatively impacts your portfolio. So we have a minimum volatility ETF, which if you want to think about it, is an anti-factor. We try to position the portfolio to relatively benefit when volatility hits. So negative volatility or minimum volatility is one of those factors. Other rewarded factors, now this is probably more apparent to other investors, value. So buying cheaper stocks versus more expensive stocks over time has historically rewarded investors. Or momentum is another pretty well-known factor. All you're talking is about is you're looking at stocks that have an upswing. So stocks that have done well recently, more than their peers, tend to continue to do better. And that's what we call momentum.
The law of physics.
The law of physics. Yeah. Until you have a pendulum and it swings backwards. Right? That's a different physics. And then the other one is really size. So really the documented rewarded factors are size being smaller cap companies or smaller market cap weight, quality or profitable companies, minimum volatility, value, and momentum are really what we call rewarded factors. And in the spirit of giving that to investors, we have ETFs that really try to capture each of those factors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
This podcast is not intended to constitute investment, legal, or tax advice. The ideas and strategies expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those recommended or implemented by RBW Wealth. Please consult and rely exclusively on your professional advisors.